The aim of the Folklore Podcast is to bring quality folklore discussion and world-class guests to its audience completely free of charge. As such, we do not carry adverts and do not accept sponsorship. You tell us you prefer it this way. In return, we rely on your support to continue making episodes of the podcast. Without it, we cannot keep going. If you enjoy the Folklore Podcast, please consider clicking the donate button at thefolklorepodcast.com or signing up for a small monthly contribution in return for exclusive content and rewards at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. If you cannot help in this way, please share our episodes on social media and leave positive reviews for the podcast in your app of choice. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Enjoy the episode. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Welcome to the Folklore Podcast. Alpine folklore has been gaining in popularity over the last few years, and in particular, much of this seems to be due to the figure of the Krampus. In the UK, the US, and in many other places, we are finding the Krampus going through a process of cultural appropriation, especially with the increasing popularity of Krampus runs. For the last episode of this season, and 2018, I wanted to align with this time of year and look in more detail at the Alpine folklore figures. But I didn't want to focus too heavily on the Krampus, as this has been discussed in so many other places. Instead, I was interested in focusing on the female Perchten characters, and how they fitted, or didn't fit, with ideas of the goddess and the witch. Joining me to discuss this subject is Al Ridenour, the creator of the wonderful folk horror podcast Bone and Sickle, and an expert on this area of folklore. His book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, is a brilliantly in-depth study of these characters conducted in the field and illustrated with some truly amazing photographs of both the ceremonies and the costumes. It is a must-have title for anyone interested in this area. Over the past 25 years, Al has worked as an author, artist, journalist, and more. And since beginning his research on the material for his book on the Krampus in 2012, has swiftly become recognised as the leading English language expert on the folklore of this character. Hi, Al, and welcome to the Folklore Podcast.
Hello.
Hi, nice to have you here. Listeners to the last episode of the podcast will know that I kind of teased this a little bit and said that we wanted to cover a bit more of the festive folklore, being December right now as we're recording this. I have on the shelf next to me your most excellent book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, which I have had for some time, and I have to say is one of the most beautiful folklore books that I think I've had in my possession for some time. The photography and the artwork, as well as the text, is just fantastic, so I would recommend that anybody has a look at that. But what I don't want to talk about very much on this episode is Krampus, and that's not through a lack of interest. It's exactly the opposite, in fact. It's that I think Krampus is being discussed and seen in so many places at the moment that actually to just regurgitate that information is probably not going to get us as far as I would like. But I can't not mention it at all. So can you tell me a little bit about how you became interested in the figure of Krampus, and maybe also from there why you think everybody else has become so interested in Krampus, and how it's being appropriated in lots of other countries other than the Alpine areas now?
I It's very different, of course. How there's been a rebirth of interest in the Krampus in Europe, and then also, well, in German speaking Europe, and then also in the U.S. when those two the embrace of the figure is very different on both sides. Honestly, I think the American English speaking embrace has even pushed the European revival somewhat. In the U.S., the figure's been embraced as a sort of way to reinvent the holiday, a sort of alternative way to celebrate. And a lot of Americans even see the figure as kind of a slap in the face of the old Christmas their parents brought them. And so very kind of sort of punk rock attitude toward the whole thing. When in fact in Europe, it's a tradition of very conservative Catholic regions. So and that's where it's been preserved. And then this idea that it's a new revolutionary subversive somehow thing has not only taken root in the U.S., but I think the European tradition has been starting to be influenced by our horror movies and our take on things, and they're losing a little bit of touch with the old meaning of the customs. But so yes, this idea of reinventing Christmas, and at the same time, these people, I live in Los Angeles, so we're full of people who want to reinvent culture every 4 years anyway. But I do see these same people returning year after year to the Krampus events that we put on, I think hungry for their own tradition regardless. So whether or not it's as revolutionary as they'd like to be, I don't know.
Do you think as well that there's a lot to do with the more general interest in folk horror as a theme now? I mean, if you think about your podcast, Bone and Sickle, which again, people, if they don't listen to it, need to go and listen to, because it has a really, really strong folklore as well as folk horror coverage. You've been discussing these ideas about the old celebrations and the returning of old celebrations and old folklore. So do you think there's a general kind of revival in folk horror itself that has a lot to do with this too?
Yeah, certainly. And the sort of hunger for ritual. People don't find ritual in the churches anymore, so they're looking a little further back. And we have this constant pagan revival going on. You have the Edinburgh Fire Festival, but we in the U.S. I was associated with people who started the Burning Man Festival, where a huge sculpture like something like the Wicker Man is burned every year, and that thing is a very, very a big deal on the West Coast in certain subcultures. So I think it's this idea of returning to ritual, this hunger, and the folk horror genre is something that's, I think, also just as a cinematic genre has really been rediscovered with things like The Witch coming out. And I do think that it has fed into it. Although I honestly think that the Krampus revival started, I would say, in the early 2000s, and I feel that the folk horror thing kind of got going maybe a little later, got a little traction a little later.
Yeah, I guess that kind of interest in the Krampus probably fed into it at this time of year, certainly, as well. So how did it work for you? How did you become interested in not just the Krampus, but some kind of Alpine lore more generally?
Well, my family was German. We definitely didn't have this tradition, and our family weren't even from that part of Germany. And it's died out in the regions where my family came from. But I ended up learning German, studying German in school, and then went studied in Germany in Berlin for a year. And at the time, this is quite a long time ago, and I remember being around Christmas, seeing these beautiful chromolith prints of devil heads appearing next to the Christmas items in various stores. And I didn't really know what it was about, but I bought one thinking it's a lovely print, took it home, put it on my fridge. And I think around the same time I was reading James Frazier's The Golden Bough and reading about these creatures with bells and whips. And in his book, the name Krampus isn't actually ever used, because that kind of was standardized a bit later. But I think I started putting it together back then, and this would have been in the late 80s, early 90s. And then as the imagery started to circulate more, there's a Chicago art collector, postcard collector, Monty Beauchamp, who published a few volumes with those images. And then those caught my eye and caught the eye of a lot of people online. And from there, the people started circulating videos of the actual events in Europe. I think a lot of folks, when they first saw those postcards, just thought, oh, this is an interesting little folklore illustration. They didn't realize that these were enacted customs. So seeing the Krampus runs and so forth online piqued my interest. I decided I have to experience this, and I started doing more and more research to see which areas seemed most traditional, and that actually tends to mean the rowdiest, that which I thought would be fun too. I wanted a little more full contact Krampus when I went there, so I ended up realizing that the Gastein Valley, which is about an hour and a quarter south of Salzburg, was like ground zero for traditional Krampus, and made it a trip over there. I hadn't started my book at that point, but I was definitely had an open eye and was making some contacts, and then followed up more intense actual work on the book a year later.
Yeah, and it can be a dangerous game as well, can't it? Kind of visiting some of these rituals firsthand as well. I mean, some are, as you discuss in your book, geared more towards the tourist trade and are a little bit lighter on their touch, perhaps. But when you get into the kind of deeper regions, they can become quite a dangerous affair.
Well, yeah, the region I'm talking about, I wouldn't say dangerous, but East Tyrol is known for being especially fueled by this kind of crazed alpine machismo. It's very, very full contact there. In fact, it's the towns of Matrai and Linz are towns where they actually discourage tourists from visiting, and there have been a lot of injuries there. It has a very different feel there than in other parts of the country. The Gastein Valley where I went is definitely unchoreographed and very spontaneous but not with the sort of head injuries that the Tri is known for.
So I'd like to move on from the Krampus to look at another element of this folklore, which I guess has similarities but also has differences. And what I'd like to discuss for this interview really more than the Krampus is the figure of Perchter. And I apologise for my pronunciation, which will not be correct compared to yours, I'm sure. But what I'd be interested in looking at as a starting point, if we may, is just to clear up any distinction between Perchter as a character and Perchten, which is more Krampus oriented, isn't it?
Yeah, everything we'll be discussing from here on out is much of it is up for grabs. History with the Perchter and Perchten goes much, much further back, and it's by that nature ends up being very spotty. So the Perchten. A Percht is many different things. At its simplest, I would say it's an alpine spirit that's associated with the winter. So again, it's the same regions as the Krampus tradition, and usually it's an ambivalent spirit. But most of the writing about it tends to show that it was more feared than more maleficent than anything else, malevolent than anything else. So the Perchten are, let me start with what they are now. The Perchten are figures associated with the Epiphany, 12th night, and the period actually from Christmas, the 12 nights from Christmas to Epiphany, but particularly with Epiphany. That's the sort of book definition. But nowadays, you will have, it's just we have people, there are Krampus runs, there are also Perchten runs. And the costumes that you've seen, the modern image of the Perche is very much looks like the Krampus. It's a fur performer wearing a animal hides and horns. There is a distinction. People will insist that the Krampus only has two horns and the Perche has multiple horns, but this is kind of something that came later, and it doesn't really apply to all regions. And for the Gastein region, for instance, I was talking about, they actually use some of the same masks. So the Perchian runs were really the domain of probably usually drunk single men in their 20s and teenage boys, probably sort of a nighttime activity that would involve costumes and disguising yourself and running around houses. In the beginning, it didn't even involve the Perchian might do some sort of performance or do a song, but it was in earlier days they would throw rocks at houses and scare off the farm animals and things like that. So these were like nighttime activities by masked kids that could get away with stuff more or less. And then so what's sort of a easy way to understand the whole Perchian Krampus relationship is the figure of Bishop Nicholas, Saint Nicholas, was added as a sort of chaperone figure almost, because there was sort of a organic need for this sort of diversion in the winter, but adding this sort of churchly ecclesiastic discipline in a sense, and giving it the purpose of educating children, kind of turned the whole thing around. It made it more acceptable. And so for a long period in the 1800s, the Krampus sort of displaced the Perchian runs. But as of late, they have returned. And I think it's really as a sort of an expansion of the interest in Krampus. So nowadays if you look at a photo of a Krampus or a Perchian, the Perchian is the singular and Perchian is the plural. So nowadays they seem very, very similar, but there are, if you go back into to the 1700s, there's a lot of different things that went under the name Perchian, including folk dancers who would perform with sort of hats crowned with long rooster feathers and costumes that are very brocade, very ornate costumes that are probably inspired by Venetian carnival costumes. Jugglers, some of the acrobatic feats were considered Perchian performers. And as Epiphany is the official, I guess November 11th is the official beginning of Carnival, but Epiphany was, I guess, the official beginning of celebrations in those regions. It's kind of, they do sort of bleed in then into Carnival performers. So it could be anything from these young ruffians running around at night with their faces blacked with soot to these sort of carnival acrobats and performers. And then there were also certain luck-bringing songs that were sung door to door, which I think is sort of very reminiscent of what you were talking about in your mumming episode or mummering in Newfoundland and so forth.
Yeah, there are some interesting similarities there, aren't there? The blacking up of the face, the masks, the guising element, the house visits. It's a common kind of theme in this type of folklore, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The face blacking, if just to go on a bit of a tangent, the face blacking, of course, it raises all sorts of, sets off all sorts of alarms and flags and so forth. But I understand that in the context, the more I read about the Perchian, there is an association between the Perchian and the dead. And so I've seen a few sources, a lot of sources actually, insisting that the blacking is supposed to represent the dead. It's also a means of just disguising the miscreants that are out and about, and not wanting to be recognized.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is you even see in Europe, I noticed that under the Krampus masks I was seeing, people would black their around, you might expect they would black around their eyes or mouths because you could glimpse that through the holes in the mask. but they take their masks off and I see their whole head is black. And I felt like this is, and one person confirmed this, one person denied it. I got sort of a mixed response on this, but it seemed like it was a carryover from the tradition of just blacking the face entirely. The Ruprecht figure who appears in Protestant Germany and is similar to the Krampus in a way also often would have his face blacked with soot.
Yeah, and it is quite common. It's a difficult area in modern times because of there are a lot of sensitive issues surrounding, obviously, the blacking of the face. But I think, and I fully understand those issues, but I do think sometimes people can be guilty of reading too much into the reasons behind some of these things.
Or reading contemporary reasons into historical cases.
Yeah,
exactly. The other thing I noticed is there are characters in these. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Krampus because traditions get really muddled in a lot of cases. So the old Nicholas plays where the Krampus first appeared in the 1700s, there's an assortment of characters, and one of the characters that was often present was a smith character, a blacksmith character, and he had a sort of infernal quality also, and you know, that's so you can look at the blacking there even as a sooty, sort of sooty hellish quality too.
Yes, yeah, and that is another common reading of it, I think, isn't it? So going back to the Perchten.
I haven't answered your question all about the Frau Perchter.
Yes, let's focus in a little bit then on, yes, Frau Perchter as the main focus of this tradition, perhaps.
So Frau Perchter is I'm hesitating here because there's so much debate and the world of the internet wants to call her a goddess, and I'm going to say she's more of a fairy character who is associated with winter, associated with domestic oversight, orderliness of the home, associated with females, especially unmarried females. So this could be the daughters, it could be the house servants, and also with children, and particularly associated with spinning. And I'm going to talk about the name too, because it's an odd name to start with.
Sure.
The name is comes from an old High German phrase, Gibbeternacht, which means the night of shining or manifestation. That's led to some, I think, misunderstandings about who this character is. So you'll often see Frau Perchter referred to as a goddess of light or the shining one. But it seems more likely that I believe the old German phrase was a way to refer to Epiphany as the night when Christ was manifest to the world, so it has to do with that sort of manifestation, I think. So basically she's named after the day that she's associated with. So you could kind of look at her name as sort of like Father Christmas is an embodiment of a date. She's Lady Epiphany. And this is like one way she was treated in the historical record. But obviously, what does that have to do? What does this have to do with the young ruffians and the jugglers and the dancers and singers of luck-bringing songs? There are questions whether they are actually related at all, or if these are just different figures and customs that were bound up in just the date itself. So, the other thing that ties the Krampus and the Frau Perchter together is this, what I was mentioning, the oversight of the children and right behavior and orderliness. And then, you know, if you think about it, we have Nicholas and day the 6th, December 6th, and the Krampus. And then a month later, you have January 6th and Frau Perchter. And the figure was said to visit homes in the same way and mete out punishments and sometimes rewards. She's actually more associated with punishments than reward. And she's depicted, there's a woodcut from 1750 where you see this ugly sort of hag-like character wearing the same sort of basket on her back with stuff full of children in the same way as the Krampus. So that character, Frau Perster herself, as a, in, apart from all of these other performers and roustabouts that are out at night, she, in that role as a sort of punisher and enforcer of order, is probably closer to the Krampus than anything.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, which I'd like to come back to in a minute, if we may. But does she have a kind of overarching role within the culture of this area? Is it purely as a punishment giver, or is her role contested in different areas, for example?
Well, it seems to change over the centuries. If you go back to the 10th and 11th century, she is she's equated with the goddess Holda, or Hola, as in the Grimm's fairy tales, but their version of the goddess Holda, who is similarly as a figure of, associated with the winter, associated with children and animals, and also the hunt. So she's been equated with Diana, also nocturnal hunt, associations with the dogs. Holda would appear with dogs, and in a few cases, Perster would too. So this, there are references, various clerics are writing about women who would claim to travel with Diana or Holda, and then later this text was modified to include Perster, on the winter nights with a company of spirits. So she kind of begins like sort of a witch-like character, or a part of a host of supernatural travelers, nocturnal travelers.
And this you mentioned the kind of similarities with Krampus, with the basket on the back, for example, and that sort of thing, and the fact that she does meet punishment as well. Can you talk a little bit about, there are some more unpleasant aspects, aren't there, to her character? I'm thinking of things like the belly slitting, for example.
I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah. Yes, tell us a little bit about that, because that's a good one.
Yes, you'll see her referred to as the belly slitter sometimes. She has a very sort of trademark way of dealing with the particular thing she would be upset about was if the spinning of the flax had not been completed by Epiphany Eve, and if she found that it wasn't, the traditional punishment would be to slash open the belly of the woman, a young woman who should have been spinning, and gut her, and fill her with debris, straw or rocks or snow, and then stitch her back up with an iron needle. The iron needle is almost always part of it too. So sort of an, I guess, homegrown taxidermy sort of thing. But she also, there's another, what's interesting is there are this punishment has given rise to this like interesting iconography. There's a town in Austria called Rauris where, they have these costumed costume performers that come around on Epiphany, who are called. This kind of character is one of the best links between these costume night visitors and the sort of folkloric figure that I've just been describing. So these people dress. They call them Schnabelperchten, which means beak. Or no beak Perchten, and so they look like birds actually. And one of the things they carry, and they come in into they look to see if the house is clean, and actually they're kind of they end up messing up the house because they have a sort of playful, mischievous spirit like the Krampuses. So they have these, their heads look like giant birds. They have sort of hinged masks with looks like a beak, and then they carry brooms. But the other thing they carry is these oversized. Replicas of the giant scissors made of wood, and that's I think it's a reference to the belly slitting. And the other thing I was going to mention was the other punishment she's associated with is stamping on children. Let's see, in Grimm quotes, Jacob Grimm has I wish I could find the quote. It's from it's in. Middle High German. The Stempe is from the word for stamp, and it's a poem that is, let's see, I think it's the Stempe is from, sorry about this, it's 50, yeah, 1350. And it's something a father says to, this, in this case, it's not a girl, it's the son, but he's warning the son on Epiphany, if he doesn't eat the entire meal as he's supposed to, that the Stempe, the stamper, will come and stamp on him. So, and in some regions, you still have the character that, for all other purposes, sounds like Fichte, that comes around on that night, who is it's all about stamping on the poor kids.
Do you think there's an element here of the kind of, and you find this in folklore a lot, of this kind of you must be good, or you must eat your meal, or do your chores, or whatever, or, and then insert threat here. This kind of the belly slitting and the stamping element, do you think they come from this kind of folkloric bogeyman warning sort of thing?
Yeah? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I just, having been so immersed in this figure for a while, people ask what the Krampus is, and usually my shortest answer is it's a boogeyman. It's just a bugaboo used to get the correct behavior, the desired behavior out of children.
Yeah.
The character that I mentioned earlier, who's depicted with the basket full of children, it's a broadside that was distributed at carnival. Her name, they call her the Butzenbärst. It's spelled as a B, Bärst in this case, but it's a Butzenbärst, and Butzen is that's a word that's used in a lot of formations that it is related to our boogie, or as in like our bugaboo or boogie. It's etymologically related. So I mean, it is what she is. Both of these characters are simply boogeymen, or I think the English may have use a slightly different term, but we boogeyman is what we would say in American English.
Very similar here too.
Threat figures, or they Kinderschreckfiguren, the child fear figures is what they call them in German, but always such a practical, concise, and explicit language.
Yeah, and it puts me in mind of a lot of the kind of traditions and folklore that come out of Iceland as well at this time of year. That's very strong in these kinds of
I'm not good on Icelandic pronunciation, but she seems like as if she's related also.
Yeah.
Sort of giant ogress.
Yes, yeah. I think there probably are similarities there, yeah. You mentioned earlier on about the connections between Frau Perchter and the mythology of the Wild Hunt. I mean, that's something that I've covered way back in the first season of the podcast,
right,
obviously with reference to my research on black dog folklore and the connections between that and the Wild Hunt. The mythology associated with the Wild Hunt kind of is very strong Teutonic mythology and spreads out from the kind of area that we're finding Perchten and the Krampus and others. So what's the connection there? How does that fit into this?
Oh, it's absolutely related. One of the tales that's told about Perchten involves figures called the Heimchen, which is actually, it's also a word for cricket in German, but they are the souls of unbaptized children, specifically unbaptized children who it was said that they would appear like will-o'-the-wisps manifest that way, but she would lead these ghostly children through the lands at this time of year in the winter. And the same story is told about Hulda too, having charge over these children that are kind of in this between world. They haven't been Christianized because they didn't receive the christening, but they shouldn't be going to hell either. So they're in this sort of wandering limbo. So you have that association with the spirits of dead children, and I think also then the Wild Hunt is more generalized. But you also see, I mean, there are also stories of Hulda, and both Hulda and Perchten were sometimes said to live underground. The Venusberg myth that Wagner wrote about, that and Tannhäuser was associated with, that's also there are versions of that where it's Holda, and so there are spirits of the dead or the fairy folks, and we know those are also sort of interchangeable at times. So, but yes, be having charge over a sort of a ghostly horde is it's common to both of those figures.
So what's the connection here between the two? I mean, you spoke a little bit about the Grimm brothers, and obviously Holder or Holler is a figure within their writings. How does this connection work with Perchta?
Between Holder and Perchta, or between the Wild Hunt and this figure?
Between Holder and Perchta, they're not interchangeable, are they? They're more connected.
They're
figures?
Holder and Perchta are actually some folklorists will even hyphenate, and I ended up doing that in my book, Holder Perchta, because it seems that it's really more just a name difference. In some cases, there are similar stories there's stories of Hold, as I mentioned, Perchta leading the Heimchen, these infants. So there's stories also with Holda doing exactly the same thing. And so a number of stories where they're the same story. So it's more in the Alpine regions, it's Perchta, and then you go further north into the regions that became Protestant, and it's Holda. And then there are other names for the figure further north. There's a great map that's just color coded, and it shows basically the same sort of winter fairy figure or goddess figure with the various names. And Perchta covers all of Bavaria and eastern Austria, and then you start seeing Holda is a lot of the rest of Germany.
Okay, so same root figure, but different naming conventions in different areas.
Slightly different associations. Holda is not really as menacing as Perchta, and not associated with punishment in the same way. I think people that want to make a case for Holda being the shining one or a more benevolent goddess figure make a better case than the association with Perchta.
And Perchta has an association too, doesn't she, with witchcraft and with the figure of the witch. Now, is that because of the punishment element, or is there a different connection there?
No, I think it's because a couple of things. I think the clerics that were trying to stamp out pagan superstitions were particularly they sort of demonized her somewhat because it was such a struggle to rid the people of their old practices. One of the practices was leaving out food offerings for her, and then particularly on the 12 nights and or on Epiphany in particular. There's stories. Let's see, there are in various books of penance. There's various penances listed for that crime of leaving out a table. They called it a Perchtentisch, a table for Perchta on those nights. So there's the sort of, I think, the clerical disgust with just the belief in this being, and then also I guess. There is there was a superstition of night traveling, the notion that people, you know, the women in particular would travel at night in their sleep state to the nocturnal revels. And Borchardt of Worms in the 10th century wrote about that, and he used the word Diana as a leader of these gatherings. Diana was considered a queen of witches at a certain point, and then Perchta gets substituted later. A later editor inserted Perchta with a insertion clause, as the people call her. Of course, all these clerics wanted to Romanize everything because that was their training and their language they wrote in. But I think they treated them more or less all as interchangeable.
So is there a big fear of witchcraft in the Alpine areas at one point that makes this association and brings Perchta into the equation?
Well, the witch's hammer was written in the Alps. The sort of set off the whole witch persecution thing in the 1400s. That was that was began in the Alps, and there were a number of ecclesiastical conferences where this was sort of the latest greatest thing the church had to deal with, and it sort of spread from the Alps outward, in especially into Germany. And you still see in the Italian Alps, there's still a practice of burning an effigy of a witch on Epiphany, also. So this fear that witches were afoot on Epiphany, that is another point for the case that Peršta was. Should be considered, should be associated with witchcraft.
There's a couple of other points that I'd like to pick up on based on some of the things that you said. You mentioned earlier about the spinning aspect of Peršta, and that's something that I've talked about as well before, very briefly, in the episode on wool and spinning and weaving and all the folklore associated with that. And there was a link that I made there, which is not something that I know a great deal about, but I found very interesting, between the figure of Peršta, or sometimes called Bertha, I guess.
Yeah.
Which kind of all links together, and this spinning aspect, and how that ties in with the figure of Mother Goose, which is a kind of storytelling figure, which is a completely different kind of character. How does that all link together?
You know what's sort of funny? I'm spacing on the French figure that is supposed to actually come from. But one of the points I've seen made about the why Mother Goose? Why was it a goose to start with? There's an association, I guess, between the goose's large foot and the treadle that's tread on in order to spin.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then I think associations have further been made then with that aspect of Peršta, the stamping aspect, the stempa or the tremble character, as sort of an alternative name for Peršta. So I didn't ever find anything really, the idea of the fates and spinning there. Didn't really see that. It seems to be an association between spinning and witchcraft that is absent with Peršta and Hulda, but the goose foot, which, and then again, also kind of brings to mind the one odd foot that devilish characters are supposed to have, whether it's a cloven hoof, or in some cases with Peršta, there's stories that she has one goose foot.
It's interesting, isn't it? I guess that really it all kind of at first examination all sounds rather tenuous, but I guess there's an underlying trope here of the one large foot, for example, which with a lot of things within folklore, you find this one underlying theme that then goes and gets included or mapped onto other characters or other aspects, and then it all starts to become interlinked. And I guess maybe that's what's happened here.
You see it over and over, and as tenuous as it may seem, the pattern repeats enough, and it is hard to ignore.
Yeah, exactly.
Asymmetry being of the devil, not natural, and or of the other world, of even the fairy world. It keeps popping up.
Yeah, do you know what? Going back to what we said at the top of this episode, I think that's one of the reasons why folklore has had this kind of resurgence and revival lately, and why people are so interested in it. And I don't know that it's any one topic necessarily. It's that whenever you start to explore it, and people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time have commented on this, you start to explore these angles and you go, hang on a minute. Wasn't there an episode about 14 ago where something very similar was mentioned? And suddenly everything starts to tie together. And you go into the kind of the ideas that Jung and others spoke about, this kind of collective memory, or the folk memory, collective subconscious, whatever you want to call it. That's what ties all of us together in some way. And that's why these things just kind of become, oh, that's really interesting. There's a link here and a link here. I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, I think, that it's a language of images, of pictures, a goose foot or a spinning wheel that, you know, it's not language bound, really. So
no, absolutely.
It may show up in a different way in another story, but it can't help but pull together the threads, so to make a bit of a pun here, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that.
Yeah. And I guess this is something that that I've explored before with the work on the motif of the black dog as well. It's this idea of symbolism. Symbolism is a language all of its own, and then meanings become fluid over time as symbols start to mean something else to other people within a changing culture.
And borrowed with a completely different, given, assigned a different meaning too, but something is powerful in the symbol. I mean, that's sort of the same way the Krampus has been assigned a new meaning in the kind of rebirth, but the symbol is powerful apart from the interpretation, in a sense. It's something, there's something compelling about the image itself.
Yes, there really is, and that's why the symbol carries on and it gets interpreted or adopted in different ways over time, yeah. Another aspect of Perchta that you mentioned that just go back to in a little more detail, if I may, is particularly at this time of year being a kind of festive time. And you spoke about the food aspect. Food is very important at this time of year, I guess, in kind of Christmas epiphany. How does that work?
It's what's interesting is, there's the association between remembering that Epiphany is the beginning of Carnival in some regions. There's an association between greasy foods some of the foods that you would, especially that we would make for Perchta are greasy fried donut type things. And that's also associated with Carnival. And we've always learned, we've been taught, or the common understanding is, well, this is because butter and fat was banned during the fast that to come, so they would use that all up. But there's a completely different rationale assigned to it with Perchta. You were supposed to eat these greasy foods because her knife would slip off your belly or make your belly greasy in some way. That's this is maybe what's called, I guess, a backwards formation or a folk explanation for it. But the image of greasy foods is associated with her. She also is there's a sort of porridge that's called Perchtan milk, or milk, you know, milk, milky porridge for Perchta that was made. And then these, you have stories of these Perchtan tables that were set out way back in the 10th and 11th century and then all the way up into the early 20th. And I doubt it's practiced anymore, but into the 19th and 20th century, Perchtan milk was set out overnight, left for Perchta, who would visit, you know, as an invisible figure, not as a costume figure. And then if the spoon had moved, there would be different fortune-telling associations with anything seemed different about the Perchta milk or when it was left out. It was also left outside sometimes because, of course, the image of these spirits flying overhead would be left in trees or on roofs, and they might, as they fly over, they notice, oh, there's a tasty bit of porridge. It's a good house. We'll bless that house.
that's really interesting, isn't it? There's a number of aspects you're looking at for the same character here of where food is important. If we think about this time of year, there's obviously the traditional within the beliefs of the figure of St. Nicholas or Father Christmas or Santa Claus, or however you want to describe it, there's this element of leaving food out for a visitor.
I always remind when I do talks about the Krampus and I end up touching on Perchta also, I always remind kids of that, or audiences, that listeners, that it's very likely related to that offering for spirits like Perchta. This is the milk and cookies for Santa.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And there's that element, isn't there? There's the offering of a gift, an act of kindness. But then,
well, the mumming or the folk play traditions, and caroling the Russian Koliada, the gift to, or even the Krampus and Perestan troops visiting homes, is the same idea that they are impersonating the spirits, and they should be paid with some kind of food or drink or something too. So it's another kind of offering, actually.
Yeah. There's this gift and offering, but then you mentioned two others there as well, which also have different folk elements to them. So there's the porridge, and that's the act of divination with the spoon, and that's very strong within seasonal folklore, is things that you can do as an act of divination to be able to find something out. So that's a separate element entirely.
And with food a lot too, because for Epiphany there's the idea of the king cake. That's in the U.S. in New Orleans, they still have that custom where something is baked into a cake, and whoever finds it foretells different things in different interpretations. But eating the food is itself ends up being a sort of divination.
Yeah. So that's the second element. Yeah. And then there's a third element here as well with the greasy food, and that's some kind of protective element. So you're gifting food, or you're using food as an act of divination, or you're using food to protect yourself from an evil spirit, and all of that associated with one character.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Okay, one last aspect then, before I let you go. And that is, we've spoken about this as being a tradition within the Alpine culture, geographically, but we've spoken about some very strong associations with folklore in other areas. So does this tie in to other countries? You've already mentioned Italy, and I know that there's a connection there, isn't there, with character in Italy. Are there others too?
Yeah, Baba Yaga, because parts of Austria also border cultures that have that figure, and one of the I have a dog barking.
That's
sorry.
Fine.
Shall I go on?
Yeah, no, carry on. It's fine.
Okay, one of the common attributes that Baba Yaga and Perishta have is the iron nose. Baba Yaga, I understand, is often described as having a nose made out of iron, and that's pretty common for Perishta also. Her the emphasis on her nose is, and I think this some writers say this is like the beginning of the notion that the witch has a certain kind of nose. But she's often given an iron nose. From 1415, there's a woodcut from a book called Flowers of Virtue in English, where there's an image of her, and she has a very much like a bird's beak. What's interesting is it looks like it's a masking figure that's been rendered. It doesn't look like it's supposed to be the actual folkloric figure herself, because there's sort of holes in the mask what look like holes, eye holes in what appears to be a mask, and then the figure has these sort of gloved hands too that don't look like human hands, but the nose is really prominent, and you know that seems to be one of the things that suggests an association between Baba Yaga and Perishta. And then as you mentioned, in Italy there's La Befana, who's the Epiphany witch, who is clearly related to this sort of family of folklore, and that extends all the way down, down to Rome. It's strong in Venice and Rome, and then further up in the Alps that are bordering more on the region we're talking about. There's a tradition of witch fires or effigy fires. So yeah, through Italy, you seem to have a figure like that too.
If people want to look into this more, there's some really great areas there to explore, isn't there? There's the links between this character and the broader traditions of the Krampus and other Christmas and Epiphany traditions. There's the links between Perchta and Perchten, and the figure of the witch as well. There's some really strong connections there for people to look into if they want to explore it more. Al, thank you. That's been absolutely fascinating, and a really good way to end this season of the Folklore Podcast and this time of year, if people are listening to this when it first comes out, obviously, just having been through the festive period as this is released. You have your own podcast, which I alluded to earlier, Bone and Sickle. The website for people who want to look at that more is just boneandsickle.com. I would suggest that everybody, if they don't already listen, does that because it really is an interesting exploration into the links, as we've discussed today, between folklore and other aspects of the kind of folk horror genre. And it's also really, really nicely put together and has an excellent soundscape and is a joy to listen to. So do go and listen to that. Your book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, which I also mentioned earlier, a great read at Christmas, but also a great read at any other time of year as well. Where should people go if they want to find out more about that, Al?
Well, the book is on Amazon. The publisher is Feral House, as in Feral Wolf, Feral House. They can look get it there too, but any online bookseller would have it.
Excellent. And what about you yourself? What are you going to be doing as we go into 2019 to further your areas of research?
I'm actually excited to get through the winter. I mean, my winter, and I'm so immersed in winter folklore beginning in late October that I'm actually not sure what we'll be doing. I know there's a dragon episode I was considering, some folk ballads that I really love to. I like to use folk music in the show because it fits the format nicely. And there's so many interesting folk ballads that tie in with contemporary culture and themes in movies. And the podcast also looks at Gothic literature and Victorian history. So we'll have to see. I'm not quite sure where we're going with the show.
It'll be great to look forward to finding out where it is going.
I'm looking forward to finding that out also.
I did very briefly appear on an episode on your answer phone. Maybe I'll come back in the new year and plague you some more with that as well.
I think that may happen, yes.
Al, thank you very much for coming on to the Folklore Podcast. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Enjoy the rest of your festive period and your rest from the Krampus work.
Thank you so much. It's been great being on the show. I'm a longtime listener and really enjoy this show too.
Thank you. My thanks to Al Ridenour for a fascinating and detailed interview on the Perchton figures. You'll find links to Al's podcast and book on the guests page of our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com. And my thanks to you for continuing to support and listen to the Folklore Podcast. It has been a challenging year in some ways, as other demands on my time have meant that I could not devote as much time to research as I would have liked. But the podcast will be back in the new year for season 4, and a new focus will hopefully mean that it is stronger than ever. You can expect more interviews from me, more extra content if you're a supporter on Patreon, and an exciting new field research project, which I hope will be immensely valuable to the area of folklore recording as a whole, and with which you can all get involved. Thanks for listening. See you next year. The Folklore Podcast is written and presented by me, Mark Norman. To find out more about my research and writing, visit www.facebook.com/MarkNormanFolklore or on Twitter with the handle @Mr_Mark_Norman. Research assistance is provided by Tracy Norman. Visit her website at www.tracynormanswitch.com to follow her historical research and projects. The Folklore Podcast will always be free to listen to and tries to avoid annoying advertising or sponsorship messages, but it cannot sustain itself. We are grateful for the support of all of our patrons who, for as little as $1 a month, earn themselves great rewards whilst ensuring our future. For more details, please visit www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. If you cannot support us in this way, please share the episodes on your social media and leave positive reviews. This really helps the audience for the podcast to grow. Visit www.thefolklorepodcast.com for more episode and guest information, to buy from the web store, or to sign up for free newsletters or get in touch. The Folklore Podcast theme music was written and performed by Gerdy Bird. Thanks for listening.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.